This is Sarah Robinson, host of DBS Radio's Conscious Creating. I'd like to welcome our listeners to our second program, where we continue to examine the relationship between art making and transformation. Last week, I discussed the experiences which led me to begin making connections between these two subjects and explored how I conceived of the title Conscious Creating and what the phrase means to me. Tonight, we'll begin a series of interviews with distinguished guest artists. Last week, I described how, when I was invited to create this show, I sat down and made a list of people with whom I would most want to dialogue on the topic of conscious creating. I settled into a receptive, intuitive mode, and the first name to appear was my favorite author of nonfiction. Well, synchronicity must have been at play, because tonight I'm privileged to welcome this very person. Thomas Moore is an internationally acclaimed writer and lecturer in the areas of archetypal psychology, mythology, and the imagination. He is the author of 15 books and many more tapes, CDs, and videos, including Care of the Soul, Soulmates, The Reenchantment of Everyday Life, and The Soul of Sex, all of which have sold millions of copies and spent many weeks on the New York Times bestsellers list. He was also trained and worked as a musician and psychotherapist, specializing in depth psychology. As a maverick teacher and theologian, his work and writing has been an agent for transformation in contemporary culture. Welcome, Thomas Moore.
Thank you, Sarah.
You know, Thomas, your life has been a very interesting one from what I've gleaned from your bio and the information I read. And I imagine that the beginning of your life was different from the current lifestyle you lead. Is that right?
Well, yes, it is very different in many ways. I grew up in a family of plumbers in Detroit. And I learned a lot from my father. He taught plumbing. He's a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot from him. But most of my family were plumbers, and my grandfather worked in an automobile factory. And I was the first person in the family to go to college. My life is really quite different from my background.
Mm-hmm. And at 13, you left home to enter a prep seminary in Chicago and went on into the seminary, where you pursued the priesthood by living as a monk in the Servite order. Is that right?
Yes. This was an order that was, you know, it's not absolutely accurate to say monk, but it's very close. I mean, it was an order where we lived the monastic style. We meditated every day and chanted psalms and had mass and silence and everything. But at the same time, we were being trained to be teachers and to work in parishes. So it wasn't, in that sense, it wasn't completely monastic. But for me, as a student, it pretty much was. And I lived that life for 13 years.
Hmm. Did you find support for your art there?
That's a good question. I could say that the artist that I potentially was came out while I was there. I had a teacher in high school when I was there as a prep seminarian,
mm-hmm.
who taught English, who knew all the arts. He was a musician and a writer, and he also loved visual arts, and he just opened the world up to me and to my classmates. So that was the opening to me to the arts, and I began studying music while I was a sophomore in high school. And immediately became interested in composition, and I studied music composition for the next 20 years.
How did you feel when you composed music?
Oh, I loved it. Even today, whatever I'm doing that's creative, I mean, here's an idea of mine, and it's based on my experience,
mm-hmm.
is that I feel best when I've created something, whether it's a book or an article. It might just be something very short that I write. Even writing a blurb for a book, which I seem to do all the time these days, it's a creative act. I see it as a little miniature, and I feel better for it. And it felt that way when I was a very young man, that when I would write a small piece of music, I felt alive, that, and I couldn't wait till the next opportunity to do it.
Mm. Did you ever experience physical sensations when you were creating, when you were writing or creating music, composing?
It's very difficult to say. In music, writing music, I found I had to go so much inside myself.
Mm-hmm.
When I had to, I did write pretty much at a piano, and I felt I had to go so much into myself to hear what I want, to hear what was wanting to be put there on paper. That it's hard to say physically. It was a kind of withdrawing for me. And you asked me before if I got support. I remember once I wrote about this that one of the priests who was a teacher in the seminary walked past me once when I was in college studying music, and he saw me at the piano, and it was during the time when all of my classmates were studying theology and that sort of thing, and he made some comment that I was just fooling around, wasting my time,
mm-hmm.
while other people were doing something serious. And there I was trying to, my assignment, I remember that day, was to arrange a Beethoven sonata for an orchestra in the style of Beethoven, which is a very demanding thing to
pretty
do.
Pretty silly stuff.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, we all have teachers who inspire us and teachers who make us work harder to be who we really are, I think.
Yeah.
So when you went on to study, get your master's degree and a PhD, was that when you began blending religion, psychology, and the arts?
Well, it was funny. I left the seminary because I felt something changing in me, maybe mm-hmm. my age or what was going on in the world around me. It was 1960s, a time of change. And so I left, and I naturally went to music. I didn't know for sure that's what I wanted to do, but I went to music full-time. And yet I couldn't leave behind my interests in religion. And I remember being at the University of Michigan, which had a very fine school of music. And I was studying musicology, and I was weaving my thoughts about symbolism and mythology into my work with music. And I think the professors there didn't understand, they couldn't quite figure me out. Didn't know what I was trying to do. And I didn't know myself. I was just that I found it quite fascinating. I was looking at, I was doing numerological studies of Stravinsky's music and things like that, and I think they thought I was a little strange. And so they asked me, they made a deal, they said they'd give me a master's degree if I would go and study somewhere else.
That's great. So you did.
So it was then, that was really the beginning of it, and then later I decided to go fully into religion and to study of world religion.
Mm-hmm. Just to go back for a minute, when you write that when you left the order, you tried to become a musician, but your interest in religion and philosophy got in the way.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious if that was a contraction for you or an expansion. It sounded a little sad to me, and I didn't know if there was sadness in it for you to give up your hope of being a musician.
Oh, it's a great deal of sadness. I still think about it every day, even now.
Hmm.
I do, because I spent a lot of time studying music. I loved it. I think I had some talent. I wasn't sure exactly how I was talented, but I knew I was. But I just didn't find my way into it. I mean, there are so many things going on. One was that I was studying with these geniuses, and they kind of discouraged me. I'd see how all the things they could do, and I thought, well, I can never do anything like that, and I'll be mediocre all my life with it. I was not a good performer. I knew I had potential as a composer, but not as a performer. So all those questions plagued me, and when I finally left, it was because I loved the study of religion, the way I was able to study it. But I always felt sad that I had to choose not to stick with music, and even today, I'm still arranging pieces and that sort of thing, but I don't do anything very serious with it.
Well, that's really good to hear that you still give yourself pleasure and those around you pleasure with your music.
I do, yeah.
Because I think it's sad when an artist turns her back or his back on something that seemed integral to who they were or are.
Well, one of my friends, James Hillman, mm-hmm. who is very astute about things, he always says that that he thinks that music enters my writing, that it's a big part of my writing. And you know, I do think that, I think that making a choice, I was choosing to do something to me, and my feeling is it was a more fated thing, that it was my fate not to be a musician, but to be a writer, and that the study of music, in a very strange way, mysterious way, supports me even now in doing that.
Well, and your study of music and your love of music and visual arts has connected you with a lot of artists. And I know, as an artist, I've been hugely inspired by your words and the musicality of your writing. I didn't think of it quite like that, but it is very musical. And so perhaps that's the purpose of the desire you have. I don't know.
Well, there's another thing that occurred to me, too, when I said that, and that is that... I remember once taking a course at the Syracuse University on what they call synesthesia, where all the arts kind of overlap and connect with each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a way in which I think just to be having been around musicians and seriously been involved in music for a long time, it was really an involvement in art as such. And whether it was music or some other art, really maybe at a certain level wasn't the thing, wasn't important. It was an art, and now it means a great deal to me to be a writer who focuses on the art of writing. Very few people talk to me about the art of writing, and I'm never, ever invited to go and speak to writers, you know, and talk to writers.
Hmm.
And I'm kind of disappointed because my primary work is to write. I think the problem is that... when you're put into a self-help category, which, you know, is not the one I'd like to be in, but that's where I'm often put, people don't take the writing seriously. They just think that you're trying to, I guess, you know, be a therapist for people in print. At least that's what the message I pick up. And so I, when someone asks me about my writing, I usually light up and talk for 3 or 4 hours.
Well, good, because I want to talk to you much more about your writing. I find that an interesting comment that the sort of the writing community, the fiction writers and poets and that sort of thing, wouldn't consider people who write self-help books as artists. But I certainly do, and learn a lot about writing from my favorite writers, and you're one of them. So, well. Interestingly, you were in Texas for a while, where you did your work in depth psychology and did some did your psychotherapy, correct?
Yes.
And was that a time when you connected with being creative or an artist? How was that for you?
To think about that is a while ago. It was a period of learning for me. I learned a great deal when I was there. I was a teacher, I guess that's why. I taught at Southern Methodist University.
Mm-hmm.
I taught courses in psychology and religion. And I found it difficult teaching at the university. To talk more about your question, I think I was learning more about, I was learning a great deal from Hillman. That's where James Hillman and I were friends, and we spent more time together than any other time. And I learned a great deal from him, working with him and listening to him lecture, and people around him, and people would come from various parts of the world to work with us. And so it was a very important period for me. But it wasn't one of a great deal of expression. I tell you one thing I did do there. One time I was seized by a novel, and I wrote a novel when I was in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And that it was an important moment for
now,
me
which
to write
one
fiction.
That?
I never published it.
Never published it. Can you
no.
tell us just a little bit about it?
Sure. It was this character appeared to me, and I just was taken by him. I had to write, and I just sat down and within a couple of weeks wrote about 400 pages, I think. And
much to your wife's chagrin, or
well, at the time I was living alone, so it was to the chagrin of everybody around me. But it was really an important experience. Certain part of me, there's a part of me, but that people don't see in my books that is, I just love humor. I just love the writers I like are very funny writers. At least I sense the humor in them. usually kind of a dark, subtle humor that I like. And this novel that came out of me was just, I was just laughing out loud at it constantly, at the things that came up. And my friends who read of it, just they told me that they rarely had read something, and so they just had to laugh constantly. So it was very funny, you know, and had serious points. But that was really a great release for me, and I often refer to the character in my own books now. But he actually appears, I mean, he's, some of the things I think I write in my books these days come from him.
Who is he?
What's that?
Who is he?
His name was Philo.
Philo
Haas. He was a psychotherapist who was responsible for the death of one of his clients, and it was quite failed, and he was sent to prison for it. And in prison, he became sort of a therapist for the other client, other prisoners. And it just was a strange, odd story.
I'm surprised your publisher hasn't tried to get it out now that you've received so much acclaim for your
book. Well, it just is not. I never polished it. It's very rough, and that rough form as it appeared. So I've never really worked at it.
Well, I do know what that's like to sit down and have something just come to you.
Yes.
Have other of your books come to you, so to speak?
Yes. I wrote a little book called, it's a bad title, I called it Meditations on the Monk Who...
Have it right here.
And that one did. I just sat down and one little story or a little scene would come to me one after the other. And that's unusual that book was written that way, just spontaneously. Yeah, just last week, or not last week, must have been a month ago, someone approached me and asked if I'd write a screenplay, and I sat down and within a weekend gave him a screenplay. And a short one for a short film. And I felt I was back in that realm again where these things appear and you don't have to work at it.
I know.
But most of my books are not like that. I work at them pretty hard.
Well, this is sort of what I think this conscious creating is you're awake, and when you're awake and you're creating it, my experience is that one doesn't have to work as hard because it's more of an unfolding.
Yes.
But back to your little book, Meditations, it is one of my favorites. It sits in a basket by my reading chair in my study where I need to frequently retreat and get in touch with my inner monk because, like you, I have two teenagers.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings me to the question, how have you managed to both preserve that part of yourself who I'm sure remains a monk and preserve the writer, the one who works and writes a screenplay in a weekend, and I can totally relate to that, in the face of family life? How is that?
It's very difficult in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's difficult to because there are so many demands on time. And I work at home, and no matter how many times and how many years I've done this, people don't understand that it's really work, you know. I mean, you don't go off. I don't wear a uniform, and I don't go off to an office anywhere. So it's rather difficult to keep the boundaries for it. But somehow it works. And, you know, the family life gives so much, both in the sense of support and in the challenge, that I think it affects my work a great deal. So, and the whole, when I can sit back and look at it, I think it's really great. But in the thick of it, you know, it's frustrating at times. I remember reading once, I think it was Raymond Chandler, but I'm not sure, it might have been somebody else, Raymond Carver maybe, who just couldn't, you know, went severely depressed because he was trying to be a family person and a writer at the same time. And I can identify with that a little bit. At moments, but in general, it's not true. It works out very well.
And it is good to be a parent, and being a parent, I think, stretches us to the limits of our sensibilities.
Also, the kids introduce, as every parent says, the kids introduce worlds that I never would know anything about otherwise.
That's right. That's absolutely right. Well, now, over half of your 15 books explore aspects of the soul. And in fact, most people who know anything about your work will probably refer to you as the soul guy, you know,
mm-hmm.
sort of the Barry White of psychology or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read where you said that we can't really define the soul, that we more have to sort of imagine it. But do you think that you have a handle on it after all this time, this ephemeral concept?
It is still an evasion, I think, probably to say that you can't say much about it. I mean, I've written all these pages and pages on the soul. But I think people really know intuitively what it's about. People even use the word soul, so at times when they really know exactly what they mean, they might use the word very passionately to say that something really has touched my soul. And that's what I'm talking about when someone says that, when they really say with passion, this has really touched my soul. Well, if it has, then you know what I mean by soul. It's something that can be touched and is so deep that a lot of things don't get to it. And yet it's so important and so wrapped up in your own personality and what's meaningful to you and your emotions. And so the best way I can possibly describe what I'm writing about with the soul is to try to describe that kind of an experience and use of the word.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that soul in some ways is like the word God?
Very much. Yeah, it's not the same word, but it's very much like the word God. Yeah, it's, we use it, and it is. And also, in the sense that many people try to then explain what they mean by the word, and so people write books and books on theology and say what God is and what isn't, and you get caught up in incredibly abstract, convoluted descriptions of the nature of God. And the same would be true of the soul. And many people, just ordinary people, want me to become, I always tell them, they want me to become Thomas Aquinas or something. They want me to start speaking in syllogisms and pulling out my laboratory equipment, to really specify what this is. And what I'm trying to say is that it's that the soul I'm writing about is something that you experience so deeply. It's very precise the moment you say that you use the word. It's very precise. You know exactly what you're talking about. But once you start trying to define it and go on and on about it and talk about its structure and everything, the more you say about it, the further away you get. And that's why I resist trying to define or be abstract about it.
And I think you're right in doing so. And the way you talk about God is a lot like the way you talk about soul.
Yes, it is.
You say that your theological work has to do with observing and reverencing the depth, the smallest and most ordinary of things.
Yeah.
This hardly sounds like the dualism of a good Catholic boy.
I know. I don't know where that came from, how I've been able to do this. I really don't know how I think it feels innate to me. It feels like something I knew from the beginning that was important to me from the very beginning. I have many sources that have confirmed for me that feeling I had. Zen Buddhism has been very important to me, very, very important in helping me find language and a support for this idea of understanding the divine as something as small as it is large. I just spent the last day reading Nicholas of Cusa, a philosopher and theologian who was a cardinal of the church in the early 15th century. I've been reading him for years and years, and I just got back to him today, reading him in Latin, because I learned Latin years ago. And he says something similar. He says that God is the very small and the very large. And God is always unfolding into the particulars of our lives and always infolding into the mystery. And I love that kind of talk. It's very Eastern, very Western. It keeps the mystery, and yet I think it has an intelligence about it, and you're describing what's important to you. Now, for a lot of people, of course, a lot of people have a notion of God or religion that is much plainer than that. I think they're much influenced by the 20th century modernist way of thinking, and they want to be able to weigh God, or to measure God, what God is, and prove somehow. To me, there's no place for proof about the soul or about God or anything like that.
Mm. Has has your art making, well, certainly I would think your writing, but even your music expanded your vision of God in some way?
Has it what?
Expanded
the vision of God?
Vision of God in some
way? Oh, yes.
Informed your vision?
You know, it's interesting that, I really do live this thing I wrote about in that book on the monk, monk's life. I'm no longer a monk, but I live a monkish kind of life all the time. And so when I write my books, I read and study. I mainly read things that were written 1,000 years ago. And I read, reading in Latin and Greek. And all of that reading, and then I study art. My wife is a painter and a professor of art. And so we have her paintings all around the house, and she's always reading interesting books about art.
What is her name?
Joan Hanley.
And does she show in Connecticut?
Joan Hanley.
Right.
In New Hampshire. And she was also raised a Catholic, but she has been practicing a Sikh form of yoga and meditation a good part of her life. So we have that in common, and in that sense, the art and the visual arts and the music have all come together. Visual arts are very important for me as a source of theology. So my notion of God has come a great deal from just contemplating paintings and architecture. So, and it's fascinating. It's the most important thing for me. Just today, I picked up one of my favorite books in my library. It's called, what's it called? Architectural Principles in an Age of Humanism. And it's about how Renaissance churches and other buildings were built on musical proportions and numbers, and how those proportions and numbers were meant to represent the nature of God. So I love that connection where the building and the art and the religion and music come together.
Oh, I love that, yeah. And what about the new physics, the physics that shows us that we can go smaller and smaller and smaller, and some say find the particle of God? How does that feel to you, and what do you know?
It doesn't have much interest to me, me.
Mm-hmm.
I used to love science. I was very interested in science when I was in high school and early college years. But I find that even the new physics, and especially spiritual writers who rely on physics and on science, I just don't. It doesn't appeal to me much. I don't feel it has shed the modernism of the 20th century enough yet.
Is it soulless?
Yeah, I think it is. I'm talking about numbers as representative, as qualities, I'm talking about putting up a building where the numbers...
Ratios, right?
Pardon?
Proportions and ratios.
Proportions, yes, like proportions of numbers in a room, that sort of thing. They represent theological ideas and... they are images, and so you live in them, you live with them. They are not abstractions. You don't stand back and say, how interesting that is. You walk into the room and you feel it, and you participate in it. And I just have not felt that excitement with the new physics. Now, because I haven't felt it, I haven't studied it much. A lot of people tell me it's just my own closed-mindedness or lack of education, which is, I'm sure is true. But I'm not going to do anything about it because I'm planning to do as it is, and I'm not interested in it.
Well, you can't know everything about everything.
No.
So that's what my mother always says. Thomas Moore is our guest tonight. If you're just joining us, we are going to take a break now, and then when we return, if you'd like to call in and ask a question or make a comment, you can do so at 1-877-876-5227. This is Sarah Robinson. We're back from our break on Conscious Creating, and my guest tonight is Thomas Moore, author of many best-selling books, including Care of the Soul. You know, another topic, Thomas, which looms prominently in your work, is sex. You mm-hmm. wrote it, Dark Eros, Soulmates, with a lot of discussion of sex and the soul of sex. Now, you have a lot of interest in sex for a guy who lived as a monk for 12 years.
I always say
what
that
gives?
I always say that the reason for that is that a monk doesn't have much else to do but think about it.
Well, there's a strong relationship between sex and the soul, isn't there?
Oh, there is.
And not just eroticism.
Oh, I think, you know, when I write about sex, what I try to do is really make it about sex, and, you know, really about sex and not something very, you know, much more amorphous. People often tell me they wish I would use the word eros instead. But in fact, I want to write about sex because I think that's really what people are really concerned about. And it's, as a therapist, I know that it's a major reason why people go into therapy and the things that preoccupy. It preoccupies people and gets them into trouble. So I want to do that, but at the same time, I want to open up in the notion of sex so that it does become eros in the sense that it's about pleasure, attraction, the desire for union, beauty, the body, sensuality, all of those things. So I really think that when we talk and think too narrowly about sex, we're not really dealing then with the problem. The issues really are broader than the way we usually conceive of them. So even if you have a sexual issue, like I often use the example of someone who, let's say someone is married and is attracted to another person and has sexual fantasy about them, that's a very frequent cause for people coming to therapy. I will still talk about their sexuality very directly about that problem, their fantasies of sex, and yet I want to look at the full life of desire in every aspect of their existence.
In contemporary American society, certainly, or Western culture, has really done a number on us about sex, whereas in the East, with Tantra yoga, there's not a hang-up about it. It's really clear that the body is here for bliss.
Yeah.
So what does our soul want out of sex?
I think it's a very good question. I think the soul is primarily, the primary need of the soul is sexual. I think it's very, very important. It represents vitality, being alive, letting life happen. And when we don't have the sexuality, the sexual experiences that we need, and again, I don't mean them just in a very narrow sense, when we don't have our sexual life really fulfilled, I think that's when we get depressed and feel aimless and purposeless and feel lack of vitality, and where the relationships break down. I don't think we realize how important it is to have a good sexual relationship and to allow ourselves to be exactly who we are sexually, which is, and there's such variety and we're so individual in it. Right away, I think our anxiety about sex comes up. And so that anxiety is translated into moralism. Not morality, but moralism. In other words, inhibitions and prohibitions that are really based on anxiety more than any question of proper behavior. I see the moralism as a defense against sex. And what is it that we're afraid of in sex? I think we're afraid of vitality. Because to be alive is a very difficult thing. To live every day knowing that your life may change every day out of desire and out of new opportunity and new pleasure, I think that's very threatening. And so people prefer, I think, to live by a death principle, which is one of repression and limitation and the willingness to go along and be depressed because you feel virtuous for it, but you don't feel happy. Hmm. I think we choose virtue over happiness.
I think so, too. And what can we do to transform that tendency in our culture?
Well, you just have to live differently. You and I can do it. I'm not sure we can do anything with the world. It's too big. The anxieties are great. I think that, in my view, are the violence, the international violence, the wars, all, I think they all have a sexual basis. We're just afraid of sex, and we become mean as a result, and that sexual potential is transformed then into incredibly you know, incredible horrors of violence which have a sexual depth to them.
And I'd like to connect art with sex somehow. Have you ever experienced art making or your creativity as an almost, not sexual experience, but maybe sort of the same kinds of excitement and feelings that go along with that?
Yes, and
I have, and that's why I'm asking you.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I mentioned before that when I have a moment of creativity, I feel suddenly very alive and I want the next experience. That's very much like a sexual feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's connected in a deeper way, too, in that, let's say in a more concrete way, in the sense that I think it's interesting that painters have painted a lot of, they're interested in nudity and exploring the human body, and there's sexuality is so palpable in painting so often. I remember once I gave a nephew of mine, he was in his teens at the time, I gave him a history of art book. I thought it'd be wonderful for him to read the history of art, and there just happened to be a painting of a nude on the cover. My mother looked at it, and she's, you know, real, you know, traditional Catholic, and said, "What are you doing to that boy's mind? You're corrupting him." She thought it was terrible. And that she thought of art as sexual, and I do too, but we had two different meanings to that.
Mm.
And so I think that, it makes sense to, when you're being creative, it's very nice to, if you don't have that inhibition and worry about it and that concern about virtue, you can enjoy the sexual so much in a very innocent way. The other day someone was asking me, the director who's going to, film this screenplay I was working on, there's a scene in it where a woman represents a spirit of water, and she's swimming. And I don't want her to be a human being. I want her to be the spirit of the water. And he asked me if she should be nude or not. And I told him, I said, well, I hadn't thought of it before, but certainly she can't be wearing clothes. I don't think spirits wear clothes. I don't think that the way we imagine they would. So I don't think she should be wearing clothes, but I don't think we should make a deal out of her being nude either, because that's not what it's about. But I do think there's an excitement about the human body and about, you know, actual sexual feeling that comes into the creation of art. That's an important part of it. And I know a lot of people get worried about that, but I don't think. I think it's something we should pursue further. And by the way, connected with this, the unspoken question here is, then why is there so much sex in movies and magazines and books? I think it's there because we are not a people who is comfortable with our sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
It's a symptom. It's symptomatically presented. But if we were comfortable with our sexuality, I think we could bring it into our art in a way where it wouldn't be overdone.
Well, and perhaps where it would be more subtle. And,
yeah, that's what I mean.
And sexier, because it is more subtle, I think. Which sort of takes me to the next question. I have shared your concern about where the soul has gone in art in 20th century America and Western culture, and in the reenchantment of everyday life. You imagine for us what a world would be like where art has more soul. And I'd like to just quote you here. You say, "A reenchanted art would once again use materials and craft as a way of housing spirits that are irreducible to an artist's intellectual or emotional life or to ideas and ideologies. Once again, archetypal themes, eternal and universal, might widely enter the arts. And through the arts, audiences might again have the opportunity to contemplate the mysteries that stir in their own hearts." I love that. And do you see this happening, Thomas? Do you think there is any movement towards art which resonates on an archetypal level?
Oh yes, I think it's widespread. I think it's every, it's, you know, a lot of people. There are a lot of good artists around, and whether they would agree with that statement of mine or not, they still, I think, in fact, are conjuring up these spirits. You know, I get that idea largely from, partly from the Renaissance writers that I've studied so much, where, you know, they saw a piece of art as almost like a tabernacle. If you create a really good image, it will be a place that the spirit will want to inhabit. It's also temples and buildings in India and Japan are described in the same way, and in other parts of the world, in Africa as well. And I think our artists are doing that. I don't think that they would subscribe to that theory, but I think they do it when they very carefully use materials. A lot of artists today who are using material very carefully, I mean, the textures and what they're putting into their paintings and their architecture and into music and into sound. This interest in music and sound design, which is not just creating melodies and harmonies, but seeing an architecture of sound and a texture of sound. I think all of that is a good step in that direction of bringing soul into it. When you work with materials that way, I think the subjectivity of the artist then fades somewhat into the background, and the materials and their demands of the materials and the shapes, whether it's visual or architectural or sound, then they have more to say. They have a greater participation in the creative process.
I'm a playwright and recently had a play produced where I collaborated with a choreographer, and the play had huge archetypal characters. I mean, Sophia, the goddess of wisdom, and in working with the choreographer, I was amazed, and the actors, I was amazed at how these archetypal images just fueled these people. It was as if they were hungry for them. They wanted them and felt really, truly transformed and moved. And I don't see that as being anything I did as much as just your suggestion to that artists might begin to go back
mm-hmm.
to these types. I think we are hungry on a soul level for a richer kind of art. And I'm interested in talking to people who are making that kind of art, and you certainly are with your writing. Actors, for one, were once part of a priestly class.
Yeah.
Do you see yourself as a type of priest?
I'm afraid so. I mean,
why do you say that?
Well, I don't want to overdo it, make it melodramatic and too
much. Well,
you know, it's something that shouldn't be said. Yes, but I do think so, that if the job, in the sense that your job is my job, is to, William Blake said that he is the secretary, the authors are in eternity.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that sense, that when a good idea comes, it has come to you and has come from someplace and someone, you might say. You don't say how that is or who that is or anything, but you understand that.
Yes.
And so I think that an audience, whether it's people at an art show opening, one looking at paintings, or if it's at a theater or a music concert, they may not express it that way, but what their soul is hungry for is a touch of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean eternity, you know, in time, but more the immortal side of life, the eternity that's within them all the time, within us all the time. And that feeds us in a way that, and gives joy in a way that, you know, it's beyond anything.
Mm.
And some artists can certainly do that. Now, an artist, for example, that really does this for me is, and I refer to him constantly, is Samuel Beckett. I think Samuel Beckett's theater is full of the immortals, you know, just full of it. And it's wonderful. And he was very careful to be very, very specific about how to perform so that the humanism wouldn't creep into it.
Yes.
And, but by humanism in the sense of the purely subjective
yes.
ideas of the performers. And it's more like it has that ritual quality to it, therefore. And
right.
so, yes, I think that our art has more or less degrees of that eternity, the eternal elements coming into it. It is chased away by our philosophy, by our culture of subjectivity and our irreligiousness, really. So it's a tough thing to talk about because I'm certainly not in favor of an old-time religion that takes everything literally and is naive, because that doesn't bring back the immortals at all.
Right.
But neither does secularism. So there has to be an alternative to secularism and fundamentalism. It's a tough thing. But if we can get to that middle point, then we get back to dances where we have masks and where we evoke things. And we're not mm-hmm. too literal, not too specific about them, even about the images themselves. So it's you know it's difficult to bring Jesus onto the stage or Zeus and Aphrodite. It's very difficult. But you could, certainly can create a theater in which those immortal mysteries are evoked in a subtle way, and we do get a taste of them. And for my money, that's worth everything. That's where we should be heading.
Right. Absolutely. And I just had a thought about Americans in particular. In America, we really don't have ruins, do we? As they do in Europe. And I wonder if we aren't really hungry for the ancient. And perhaps if that could be provided in the art created in our country by our artists, if that wouldn't feed society in some way. I know that's a big thought, but...
No, it's a very good thought. There is a chapter on ruins in that book, I think, of mine, Reenchantment. I haven't looked at it in 10 years, but...
Which one?
Reenchantment.
Ah.
Yes, I think I spend a lot of time in Ireland, and one of the reasons I love Ireland and England is to be close to the much older structures and things. I was able to lean against a rock at Stonehenge last summer for a couple of hours.
Mm.
I just felt in a very good place. I was at Avebury, and then in Ireland we often stop by old churches, very old things. And you do contact the eternal, not just because a thing is old, but because people of another time didn't have the same philosophy we had, and we're more open, I think, to those eternal, that eternity that was just ready to step right into your life. W.B. Yeats was very good at describing that experience,
yes.
of how the other people from the other world just walk into your home very easily. If you leave the door open, they come in, he says, you know. And that's a sensitivity we don't have. We leave our door open, we're afraid someone's going to steal something, but we don't know that the eternals might walk in. So, but I think in America we can still have that experience. We do have old things. We have old buildings that go back a couple hundred years. That's okay. That's something. But we're tearing those things down, too.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really a disaster.
Yeah.
So
and the
trees. We need to protect our old ruins, whatever they are, however old they are.
Right. You know, I had another question for you. I was looking at your life and started out in Detroit and Chicago and then the different universities in Dallas. And then ultimately, you wanted to go to New England.
Mm-hmm.
Does setting inspire you?
It does. I didn't know at the time it would, but it does. I think I discovered that when I first visited New England. I didn't expect much really to happen, but when I started getting to know the area of especially Western Massachusetts when I first went there, I found something that was I found a geography that was very, very enchanting to me, full of magic in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts.
Mm.
And I found a lot of other things there as well, and then I began reading the New England writers more. I was out in the Berkshires. I would read Melville and Hawthorne and Emerson and a lot of Emily Dickinson. I lived very near Emily Dickinson's house for a few years. And,
mm.
and so that presence was important. Margaret Fuller here in Groton, Massachusetts, not far away. I go past her town all the time.
You like Anne Sexton too, don't
Anne
you?
Anne Sexton,
yeah. She's great.
So I discovered that there's something about New England, for me at least, that works very well. It's a tough place to live in. People can be tough and the weather's tough. But it has something that's important to me, and I feel pretty good at it. I have to admit I feel more at home in Ireland, but I feel my second home is in New England.
Did you? I know your wife was working in Ireland. Did you work in Ireland as well?
I've lived there off and on throughout my life. I first lived there when I was 19 as part of my monastic life. I lived in north of Ireland for 2 years. And then we've gone back and we put our kids in Irish school for a year. And I really got very absorbed in Irish culture at that time. And I go back 3 or 4 times a year to lecture and to see friends and family and to participate in the life there. And we're going in about a month to look for a house, not to live there permanently, but maybe half the year.
Mm. How lovely. I wonder, as we're ending this talk, if you will indulge me in a little word association game before we close.
Sure.
Okay. So I'm going to give you a word, and I just want you to give me the first word that pops into your head.
I have to be honest about that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You can't be smart-alecky.
Okay.
You have to be completely. Okay. So here's the first word. Art.
The first image that comes to my mind is the struggle to find images, the struggle to be an artist. Yeah, the life it takes to be an artist. It's very demanding. I just have an image of somebody just trying hard to be an artist. It's not easy.
The suffering artist or the struggling artist?
Yeah, something suffering. Yeah.
Sort of Sisyphus.
Yeah.
Creativity.
Creativity, my first response to that is Zen. It means not to think about it, just be creative, just do your work and not think about being a creative person. I think the thing that stands in the way of being creative is worrying about being creative. So my first thought was Zen, meaning just do it.
Imagination.
I don't know why the first thing that comes to mind is prayer.
Prayer.
Yeah. Imagination to me is not something, it's not cleverness, it's not coming up with great ideas. It's a very, 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 very deep thing. It's a very deep thing beyond where you just find some doorway and you way past what's normal. You're in a very abnormal, eccentric place and you find things that you wish you hadn't even seen, you know. And that's the imagination. The word imagination is usually treated in such a light way, probably to defend against its power.
Mm-hmm. Inspiration.
Inspiration, I think of James Hillman again. Jim and I gave a weekend workshop in Chicago on inspiration. And it was wonderful doing that. I was inspired. I've been inspired. We talked about the people who inspired us and I think of that all the people that I could list, I could give you a very long list of people that have inspired me and continue to do so.
I'd love to have that list. I'd love to look at who inspires you.
Well, we each have them, you know.
We'll have to.
A great thing.
And then the final
one. Can I talk more about that?
Pardon me?
Can I talk more about that?
Oh, please. We're about to close, but we can.
I know we are. Let me just tell you one thing, that in the Renaissance times, people were honored very carefully what they call the Prisca Theologia, which means their ancestors, the people that have inspired them over time, whether they knew them, whether they were alive or dead, your own particular list of people who have inspired you.
Mm.
Okay, folks. Well, we need to wrap it up a bit because we only got about one minute to get the next host on.
Thomas Moore, thank you for being with us tonight. It's been a real pleasure, and I hope you'll come back.
I'd love to. It's been a great pleasure for me.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a Service to Others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.